You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. Yesterday morning, Bon Appetit launched a new website called Healthy-ish. You can find it at behealthyish.com, behealthyish.com. And you'll find all sorts of tasty, delicious, healthy recipes and cool people and places, but not, you know, too healthy. Still fun. Still got to have that ish in life. So on today's episode, we are talking with a few people who contributed to that site, as well as our February Healthy-ish issue. First up, Carla Lolly Music chats with Nate Appleman. Nate was a chef, James Beard Award-winning chef at A16 in San Francisco, and then moved to New York and was at Polino's in downtown New York. And Nate was just not a happy chef, sort of had a tough patch in his life. But you know what's a good thing? He started eating well. He turned his life around. And Carla talks to him about how he did that, where he's at now, where he's cooking, and how he has found healthiness and happiness through good eating. And then I talked to my good pal, associate editor Emil Stonick, to break down how you can be eating meat in a smarter way, knowing what to look for, how to cook sort of more sensible cuts of meat, how often you can and should be eating meat. As a meat lover, I think we need to do our part, and I think we need to be smarter about it, but I think we still need to indulge in what we love. And as part of this whole healthy-ish initiative, Bon Appetit is teaming up with Sweetgreen to celebrate. From today through February 1st, you can order Bon Appetit's Healthy-ish Bowl for pickup on the Sweetgreen website at sweetgreen.com. It's got herb falafel, shredded kale, warm quinoa, cilantro, cucumbers, raw beets. I'm getting hungry. Local feta cheese, some warm local squash, spicy sunflower seeds, fresh squeeze of lime. Oh, man. I literally have not eaten lunch yet. I'm getting very hungry. So order that at sweetgreen.com and hit us with an Instagram and we'll tag you and regram you and all that sort of good stuff. All right. Now up, Carla Lolly Music and Nate Appleman.
Nate, what's up?
I'm here.
You are?
Bon Appetit.
Yeah, in person. The last time I saw you, you had just come back from Ohio after the opening for Tasty Made.
That is right.
And how's it going?
I've been making a lot of burgers, fries, and shakes, actually.
You personally?
Here and there.
Okay.
We have a great team of people making the burgers, fries, and shakes, but, you know, I tend to jump in and help out whenever I'm there.
So you've been traveling back and forth?
I have. I've been going to Ohio at every other week at this point. Minus Christmas, I took a little vacation for myself.
Nice. So this is interesting because the story with your recipes that is in this issue is really all about your philosophy of cooking for your family at home. And it's a very healthy philosophy. And then your day job takes you every other week to Ohio, where you're working on this new burger shake and fry concept and also overseeing all the Chipotle stores. Like, what is that back and forth like for you?
Well, I'll tell you, the travel really puts a damper on my home cooking.
I bet.
But at the same time, because I travel so much, I really focus on when I am at home, cooking at home. So I'm not eating out in restaurants. And, you know, I'm very conscious about what I put into my mouth.
So let's talk a little bit more about your cooking and your dinner philosophy, which really started with breakfast. So what was your breakfast? What do you have for breakfast today?
Today I had 3 eggs scrambled.
The whites? Okay.
Whole eggs. And I had a big spoonful of yogurt, full fat Greek yogurt with za'atar, lots of olive oil, and a big piece of fried toast.
Awesome. All right. So this is like a little bit of, I think in a way that summarizes some of the things that I learned from spending time and cooking with you. There's whole foods, right? It's the whole egg, full fat, dairy, oil. You're not afraid of fat.
I'm not afraid of fat. Full disclosure, I did run 8 miles at 6:30 this morning. So, you know, I probably eat more than your average person for breakfast, but I need it.
Right. Talking about what's in your diet instead of what's not in it. So like what is the foundation of the way that you cook and eat?
Definitely whole foods. And I also like a nice balance of things. You know, I don't go too heavy in one direction. I don't eat huge pieces of meat and little bit of veg. It's more of a balance of all these things combined where you get a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But I never skimp on things like fat or dairy, you know, whole fats, things like that. I really just, I mean, I could be completely wrong and I don't have any scientific proof on this, but I don't think fat makes you fat.
Right.
I think not, you know, exercising and eating tons and tons of processed food full of sugar probably makes you fat.
Yeah, I think that the word is out on sugar right now. There's a couple books that are out and articles where really that idea that calorie for calorie, that every calorie is the same, has been debunked, right? So a calorie from a whole food versus a calorie from sugar, completely different.
Completely different. And that's why, you know, if you look at something like Chipotle, Chipotle is whole foods. You know, it's unprocessed whole foods with minimal ingredients. You know, we always get dinged for having high salt, mm-hmm. but salt is a natural ingredient where all these other companies engineer their food. I say engineer because they truly engineer it to where it has, you know, the right amount of sodium, blah, blah, blah,
right.
which I can't even pronounce, you know, just to get under the guidelines so they don't have to say it has too much salt in it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's crazy to me to think that something like salt has such a bad name because it's a natural product.
Right.
We need it in our diet.
I think for people who are on a low sodium diet because they have hypertension or something else, that's one thing. But for most of us, eating, as my mom always told me, maybe it's true, maybe not, but she always has said eating salt doesn't give you high blood pressure. If you have that, then that's something else. She actually has low blood pressure and eats lots of salt.
Well, good
yeah.
for her.
Yeah, she likes the hard pretzels with the big salt crystals on them, and she eats those with soft butter.
Because it's delicious.
It's a really good snack, actually. And this was another thing that I found really interesting from talking to you when it gets into a question of flavor. So like even in the breakfast you just described, there's like there's the za'atar. There's no blandness in this. This is like a rich diet with a lot of flavor. And one of the things you mentioned was actually cooking with a little bit of sugar, that was something that kind of evolved in your home cooking game.
Yeah, I think that's something evolved over time. You know, interestingly enough, when I was fat, I probably never cooked with sugar.
Uh-huh.
But now that, you know, I'm on this kick to find balance, I guess. And, you know, you and I have talked about balance so much that you're probably like, you don't even know what balance is because you're all over the place. But truly, you know, a little bit of acid, a little bit of sugar, or sweetness of some sort, you know, in the salmon recipe, there's the raisins.
Right.
You know, it also has vinegar. It also has lemon. It also has yogurt because it, you know, adds that fatty, rich creaminess to it. So it's really for me, it's about balance.
Right.
And if sugar adds a little bit of that, you know, balance to the dish, then I'm completely okay with putting it in there. But I'm not, you know, I just don't eat spoonfuls of sugar.
Sure. But I stopped putting honey in my tea this week. I read another article, it was in the New York Times opinion page, about a guy who does this like no added sugar diet reset basically for 30 days every year, where he stops eating all foods that have any added sugar, which, you know, includes things like wheat thins and, you know, every packaged cereal. And, you know, you start looking at labels, like even a Siggy's yogurt, which is high protein and strained and low fat. It's got cane sugar in it, you know? So anyway, I stopped putting honey in my tea this week and I'm like every day, I'm like, but it's so delicious. I miss it so much. But I do feel like my palate is changing.
Yeah. And it will, you know, after 30 days, your habits will change.
Right.
So I guess in a sense, your palate changes as well, but it's just, it won't be part of your daily routine.
So I don't know if you have this problem because I do. And I also have a dinner story in the same issue where I talk about this because I cannot put honey in my tea in the morning. And then I come into work and, you know, we're tasting morning buns. There's peanut brittle. There was gluten-free banana buckwheat cake. There's, you know, this is my actual job. I'm sitting at my desk yesterday and Rick Martinez, one of our food editors, comes up. He's like, hey, do you have a second? And he's holding a bowl of bread pudding. And it's like, I'm actually contractually like obligated to eat that right now. And do you find the same? Does that happen to you if you're spot checking in a store or you're out doing shakes and fries in a part of Ohio that doesn't have a ton of other food options? Like,
yeah, you know, it's been a journey for me. You know, I went through many different phases to lose weight over time. And there was a time where I did eliminate things from my diet. You know, I went 2 years without having added sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that did. Maybe it reset my habits, but at the same time, I think I probably lost out in the same time.
Right.
You know, I had a pastry chef that she was amazing, and I just had to tell her, like, I have to trust you, which was good on one sense, but at the same time, you know, I wasn't able to be that guiding light for her to say, like, hey, maybe you could do this or that.
So you literally didn't taste.
I didn't.
Wow.
And you know, that's hardcore.
But, yeah.
But also I weighed 250 pounds. And
right.
I knew that I had to be disciplined to get where I wanted to get. At this point in my life and my journey, I don't eliminate anything.
Right.
I just don't. I know that I know how to properly regulate what I eat.
Mm-hmm.
I don't overeat. I exercise a lot and I get plenty of sleep.
Right. Oh, sleep. Yeah, that's my number one thing right now. Also, everybody should be sleeping more.
I think so. It makes you happy.
It does.
Yeah, you know, habits are hard to break. And I mean, think about, you go to work every single day, you do the same routine, you work in a restaurant, you eat late at night. So it was a process. It was something that I had to learn. And I only learned that by being in tune with how I felt. But that took time in itself. You know, I would run in the morning a few blocks or whatever mm-hmm. it was that I can make. And then I wouldn't eat. I would still have that habit of not eating breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would show up at work and I would get to work, or, you know, I would do my work for a few hours and then I would crash. First thing I would look for is sugar. So it was probably, I was working against myself.
Right.
And it wasn't until, actually, somebody who worked with me gave me a book called Ultra Marathon Man.
I know about that guy. He's insane.
Dean Karnassus, right. Or whatever his name is. And he was talking about how he started running. And, you know, reading that book, you know, not only gave me an idea of like, oh, I need to change a few things. It also gave me the will, I guess, to say, you know what, as a human, you can overcome almost anything. This guy just went out and ran 100 miles.
Right.
Like, I'm complaining about running 2 blocks.
Right.
I could probably make it 3 blocks. And then I just kept that same mentality to 4 blocks, to 5 blocks, whatever. And then I started running marathons.
Wow. That's a lot of discipline. And you've run how many marathons now?
4 marathons. And, you know, I'll never run one again.
No? Why? That was it?
I did it. And it consumes you. I mean, it definitely takes up a lot of time. The other thing is I'm very competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And as you get older, you just naturally slow down, I guess. So I think I would be crushed if I couldn't beat my previous times.
So when you say you were competitive with yourself.
Well, not only that. What the funny thing is, like, you know, each marathon, they talk about all the chefs that are running it.
Uh-huh.
And I would just, I would follow all the chefs just to make sure that I beat them. And I mean, some are like way out of my league. But, you know, Marcus Samuelson runs it in like,
oh, wow,
2 hours and something.
Oh, you know? Just flying through the air.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, I can never, ever achieve that. But I'll say I did pretty well against the other New York chefs.
Okay, good to know. We'll look up those stats. Yeah. Let's also talk about cooking for kids, because the way that you describe your son, Oliver, eating, I think will make parents of picky eaters just like roll over on the floor and die. He seems to be open to kind of anything you put in front of him. But what are some of the strategies that you've used to get him to try everything?
Well, I think the best strategy for cooking for kids is make it delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And also don't have any preconceived ideas of kids don't like green things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where does that come from? You know, I have no idea. Maybe they don't like green things, but, you know, mine tends to, unless it's like big hunks of spinach, and then he gags.
Okay.
So, I mean, there are those things out there that do happen. And you know, I have to plan accordingly. Like the spinach thing, for instance, instead of putting whole leaf spinach in dishes, I will chop it up very fine and mix it in. And not that I'm hiding it.
Right.
But it actually makes it, you know, depending on what I'm cooking, it is probably better to, you know, a better way of eating it as well.
Right.
But, you know, I really don't make kids' food. I make food that, you know, I want to eat. And, I mean, it sounds bad, but he doesn't have a choice.
Right.
You know, he eats what we cook. And, you know, I've never really had a problem. I mean, he hates mushrooms. If he detects mushrooms in a dish, like, forget
it. It's off.
Yeah, it's off. But, you know, he has a palate like no other. You know, he can pick up flavors way better than I can. We'll be eating something and be like, did you put ginger in here?
Wow.
I don't know. I think I'm proud. I'm proud to see that because, you know, I have cooked this way for him and I've never cooked children's food for him. And, you know, I don't believe in it. And I think the hangups that, you know, parents probably have are from their own childhood.
Right.
You know, eating bad food. But nowadays, look at everything is at your fingertips. You want to learn how to cook, you can go to YouTube.
Right.
You know, go to Bon Appetit.
Yeah.
You know, look on the website. The videos just show you step by step on how to cook. So, you know, I think more and more people are venturing into that. And
yeah.
I think we're in a good place because, you know, the whole bland food, children's food,
yeah,
hopefully will go away.
And your philosophy about fish also, and fat. Talk about your favorite fishes.
My favorite fish are ones that are full flavored, full fat. And, you know, partly because of the cooking of it.
Mm-hmm.
You can take, you know, like a tuna belly, for instance, and you can overcook it and it's still going to be delicious. You can take fatty salmon, overcook it, and it's going to be delicious. And that, I believe, will give people some comfort in cooking at home because
right,
there's nothing worse than going out and spending $20 a pound for something and then ruining it.
Because it's dry or overcooked or, yeah.
You know, just like completely ruining it. Now, if you buy these fattier fishes, not only, you know, the fishes like mackerel and sardines and some of these like this, not only is it better for the environment and for the ocean, but I think it's better for you,
you know,
from a cooking standpoint, but also from, you know, a health standpoint. Lots of...
The omegas.
I'm trying to sound professional with saying omega.
I think also fat is flavor, but fat is also satiating. And if you're eating a very, very lean diet, it's hard to feel full. So things like fiber will make you feel full, and fat and dairy, that richness is important. But you can get it from nuts. You can get it from fatty fish. You can get it from the dairy. But even, the fatty bits on the pork chops, like... Enjoy.
Yeah.
You
should, because if you're not satiated, you know, right after dinner, you're going to go to your snack cabinet and you're probably going to make the wrong choice.
Right.
But if you eat really good, wholesome foods, full of fat, full of deliciousness, you know, you're not going to grab those Wheat Thins or whatever it is and try to feel satiated.
All right. Let's talk about a snack cabinet. You brought it up. What's in the snack cabinet at the Appleman residence?
Lots of pretzels.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Which kinds? Are you a pretzel rod man or like a mini or a German style?
Two different kinds.
Okay.
So, you know, the pretzel chips?
Uh-huh.
I think they're called crisps, maybe. So I have lots of those, probably two packages right now. The everything flavor, like everything bagel.
Totally.
And then also the Dutch style pretzels. The
Snyder's.
Snyder's.
Yep.
Love.
Little soft butter. Do it my mom's way.
I'll give it a go. And then Cheez-Its. That's my... Cheez-Its are my guilty pleasure, if that is a guilty pleasure.
Yeah. That's a lot of things in a Cheez-It.
Probably.
Yeah.
But I like it.
The texture's amazing.
I even saw last week they have whole grain, which is probably complete bullshit.
But
you know, it makes
there are
you
some
feel
whole
good.
Grains in there.
Yeah, it makes you feel good about yourself.
So we're going to go into the lightning round now.
I'm ready.
We don't even have to really talk. It's just like one word. But people have trouble with this. And, you know, if we have to discuss, we will. But basically, you're given a choice and you have to choose. And it's not for today. It's for life. Okay. Start off in an easy one. Peanut butter or almond butter?
Peanut butter.
Always. Black pepper, like ground black pepper, or chili oil?
I mean, so different.
So different, I know.
Chili oil.
Chili oil or red pepper flakes?
Red pepper flakes.
Interesting. Burrito or taco?
Burrito. Well, I mean, that takes more than one word, really. Burrito at Chipotle, 100% of the time. Taco in Mexico
California. Right. What about burrito at Chipotle or burrito bowl?
I never burrito bowl.
Really? When I used to go to Chipotle, I would burrito bowl.
I'm not a bowl.
Love the bowl. But then I did the calorie tally once because I always would get guac and always would get sour cream. It's like 1,000 calories.
Of deliciousness?
Of very delicious. But like, you know, that's it for the day. All right. This is burger related. In-N-Out or Shake Shack?
In-N-Out.
And why?
Price.
Really?
Not that In-N-Out has great fries, but I think they're better
fries.
Than Shake Shack.
I thought you said price.
Well, no, I did say price.
Oh, you did. Oh, you know, now you're going into fries.
Price and fries. Price and fries.
The price of the fries. What about In-N-Out versus Tasty Made?
Tasty Made.
Okay. That's good.
Back up.
Okay.
At Tasty Made, we took all the negatives that come along with In-N-Out, which aren't many, but we made them better.
Name three.
Fries, burgers,
fries.
And shakes.
Your burgers are grass-fed, right?
No, they're not.
Okay.
They're not. But, you know, we use minimal ingredients. Our buns are made with, you know, wheat, water, yeast, eggs, salt, you know, the things that should be in bread. Our shakes are made with cream, sugar, eggs, vanilla, milk.
So whole ingredients.
Whole ingredients.
Like your diet. Yeah.
Our fries are made to order. They're peeled, twice fried, which I think is where In-N-Out goes wrong. They only do a single fry. We do a double fry.
With a low temperature and then an increased temperature? Or are you frying at the same temp both times?
Yeah, two different temperatures.
And is it a russet?
It is a russet, yeah.
Did we do butter or olive oil yet?
No, but it's olive oil.
Cool. Me too.
But I love butter.
I know.
But not in that French way.
Right.
It's just, you know, it's different. I'm not scared of butter. How about that?
No fear.
Brown butter, different story.
Like or don't like?
Love.
Love. Okay. And then let's just wrap it up with one. Might be feel a little close to home with your Italian background and it at A16 and everything and Polino's. Rice or pasta?
Oof.
This is for life.
I mean, my kid is half Asian. I got to go rice.
You make rice every day?
There is rice in my house every day. Yes.
Awesome. Thanks for coming in. It was great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
All right. That was Carla and Nate. And now here is me and Emil. So, Emil, we have our healthy-ish issue on stands now, and we got all sorts of, like, I don't know, turmeric tonics and avocado and yogurt and all that. And then you went ahead and did, like, a 10-page story called Eat Your Meat.
I went ahead and did it.
I don't know. Does it jibe with the rest of the issue?
I wouldn't even say it's part of the ish part of healthy-ish. I think it is in the healthy category. I mean, growing up in the 90s, it was like, meat's bad, saturated fat's bad, eating animals is bad.
All that.
And it's like, we are past that point. We know that eating meat can be a part of a healthy diet. And I think a big part of this package is, you know, we've been hearing since Michael Pollan and the Omnivore's Dilemma and all of that we're supposed to be eating less meat, better meat, more vegetables. And I think that people understand that, but there aren't a whole lot of strategies for actually how to do that at home and what that means.
Yeah,
so that's what this package is trying to do.
And I think at home is important. I think when we go out to eat, we'll see, you know, a lot of times they'll say where the meat comes from, what ranch, grass-fed. They'll use it in moderation, more vegetables. So I think, yeah, the aim, as you said with this story, was, well, how do we bring that home? And I guess my first question is, obviously, if you're going to eat meat and you want to buy better meat, well, what does better meat mean? Where are you buying this better meat?
Right. So, well, in this package, we kind of organized it into good, better, best. You know, and the kind of good first step is like, yeah, you don't want to be getting the shrink wrapped stuff in the, like, you know, cold case at the grocery store. Like, you really want to be going somewhere that has a little more attention to the way the animals are being treated, a little more attention to the butchery. So, like, a place like Whole Foods or like a better, you know, quote unquote, better supermarket is kind of a good place to start. You know, Whole Foods has their animal welfare scale, so you can walk in and, you know, you get to kind of choose. Do I want the local ground meat that's going to cost a couple dollars extra? Do I want this ground meat that is at least, we know that it's not being fed growth hormones and that kind of thing? So that's, I feel like, a good place to start.
Yeah.
And after that, you know, going to your local farmer's market obviously is a good choice. You know, you're buying a lot closer to where those animals were raised then. And you're also supporting farmers who are raising animals, which is costly, and you're kind of cutting out the middleman. The only disadvantage there is that a lot of times you're buying meat that is frozen, which doesn't affect the quality, but it means that you can't have it cut to your specifications, mm-hmm. and you're kind of buying what they've got.
Yeah.
And probably your best case scenario is going to your local whole animal hipster butcher shop, where they're getting whole animals in from farms that they trust. They're breaking them down into cuts, and you can call ahead and special order. You can also go and they'll talk you through, you know, how a certain cut is going to perform when you're cooking with it, based on whether it's, you know, grass fed and leaner or grain finished and a little fattier. They'll be able to tell you what cuts you might want to buy instead of the cut that you were looking for that they don't have. So there's just like a lot more, it's kind of a more educational experience.
It's like getting a made-to-measure suit instead of just some off-the-rack thing. Can I bring in fashion?
You can bring in, I mean, having never had gotten a suit made for me, I don't know.
but no, it's interesting. I was actually talking to the owner of Dixon's Farm Stand Meats in Chelsea Market here, which is a great whole animal butcher, similar to the Fleischer's, which we have in New York, White Gold, which just opened up on the Upper West Side. Couple of things. I mean, a lot of times this meat is more expensive, and some will argue, well, meat should be more expensive. I mean, one problem we have is meat has become so affordable, so pervasive, you know, just the way it's raised, it's become much more of this factory, and that in itself might be problematic.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of, I don't know, it is good that it costs more in a certain way, insofar as that means that butchers are getting paid, it means that people who are raising meat are getting paid more, or are able to make a living doing this. It's also kind of an effective stopgap for you as a consumer, and you're like, okay, well, I can't just go and buy a big ribeye every night, because now that ribeye costs $50 instead of $12. So how am I gonna figure out how to buy less of this meat or buy more strategically and still get to eat?
Yeah, and I think and we've done pieces on these sort of new school butcher shops which are popping up. What I love about them is you know, you'll get some off cuts, some stuff you're not typically used to getting. But what's also interesting, because they use a whole animal, they use every last bit of it. So you often go to the freezer case and they'll have, you know, beef stock, chicken stock, pork stock. They'll make pâtés, they'll make rillettes, they'll make all sorts of stuff of every little bit. You can buy like the schmaltz, the chicken fat. And it becomes like this sort of one-stop shop for all sorts of your sort of meaty needs.
Totally. And that, I think that is a really fun part of going to those shops. Yeah. You know, you come in knowing that you need some stew beef for dinner, but then you're like, well, the freezer case has all these things that I can just, you know, bring home and just have ready to pull out when you're like,
or they'll make beans, when the beans will have little bits of cured pork in there, or
like ramen stock or whatever. You know, that's, I think, they're there to help you in all of this. They're like your partner in eating better meat.
And when you go to shops, ask a lot of questions, engage the butcher, get into it with them. Because typically if these places, they're passionate about it too, and they want to help you, and they want to get into it with you. All right, so let's go through a few tenets from your story that you sort of advise for the home cook. Your first one, which is interesting, which I think a lot of us don't think of because it seems very sort of like what we grew up eating, start from the ground up, and you're advising that we eat more ground meat.
Yeah, I mean, ground meat, I think, for me at least, is my go-to when if I'm going to a place that sells good meat and I'm not really sure what I'm going to cook for dinner, that's the thing that I'm going to grab, and I'll figure it out on the train ride home. But it's affordable, it's super versatile, and when you're getting it from a high-quality shop, it's not like mystery meat, you know? They know that it's coming off of the animals and the cuts that they're trimming. So it's good meat, and it's being ground there. So it doesn't have that kind of, you know, that weird like squishy texture sometimes that like yes. bad ground meat has. It has almost like kind of like a, this is a gross description, like a loose kind of ropey quality to it. And that is like what you want for your meatballs, your smash burgers, your kebab, you know, your like kofta.
So you're, so you're not just buying beef. You're buying ground lamb or ground pork. Yeah. What are some things that you would make with ground meat that I probably have not or might not have thought of?
Well, I mean the recipe that we featured in the magazine to kind of as proof positive at this point is a lamb larb, which is larb is the kind of Thai spicy salty meat salad. Basically, you just brown a bunch of ground meat. You add,
so here it's lamb.
Yeah, so here it's lamb. Often it's made with pork, I think. And you know, it has all of that. In this case, it has kind of all of that aromatic, like gamey lamb quality.
So how are you making it? You got your ground lamb, then what are you doing?
Yeah, so you're taking your ground lamb and you're browning it really hard in a pan, in a cast iron pan, getting it nice and crispy. None of that like gray mealy.
No.
Crispy bits. You want all the crispy bits. Yeah, it's like eating a bunch of burgers chopped up together. Yeah. You kind of chop up the meat in the skillet while it's browning, and you're adding fish sauce, and you're adding sugar, and you're adding soy sauce, and chilies, and garlic, and ginger. So it's nice and aromatic, and that is kind of the topping for your lettuce wraps with rice and cucumbers and a little lime and peanuts. So you have this very flavorful ground meat mixture that you don't actually have to eat that much of in like a given wrap in order to get the full effect.
Yeah, I think it's interesting with what they always advise. If you want to eat less food, season your food. Mm-hmm. And it packs a punch. It's pungent. It's salty. It's fragrant and balanced with the sort of the crisp bracingness of the lettuce and everything.
Totally. And I love doing a kind of a similar thing to the larb, but instead of it being like a more of like a dry mixture, adding a little bit of stock or something like that to get it kind of nice and juicy and saucy, and then just pouring something like that over a bunch of blanched kale or a bunch of steamed broccoli or whatever, all of a sudden that feels like a meat sauce.
You're getting me excited.
Yeah, right?
All right, what about you also mentioned with ground meat sometimes, like you like to cut it. You like to mix in other stuff into the ground meat to sort of extend it. Is that correct?
Oh, totally. I mean, well, you think about meatballs, you know, classically, there's some breadcrumb in there,
egg
and all that stuff. So, you know, you already know that ground meat plays well with all of these things, but you can also mix in whole grains if you wanted to make little...
Like
farro or brown rice.
So you would cook that, let it cool.
Totally. Bulgur, let it cool, and then actually just fold that into the meat along with whatever seasonings you want. And, you know, that way you kind of have, if you want to brown those off into like little patties that you put on top of a rice bowl or
just a crumble like this. But to your point that like, hey, here's a way to eat less meat, but you're still getting all the flavor and fat from the ground lamb or pork, but you're instead of serving two people, you can now serve four people with that.
Absolutely.
All right. I like this. I like where we're going with this. Whole chickens, which I think most of us Americans were used to going to the grocery store. You got your little packets of like boneless breast or boneless thighs, or I'm always like, the whole chicken, isn't that kind of a pain in the ass? Like, what am I, do I have to take it apart? Like, you know, what's your whole chicken policy?
I mean, that's the thing is, you know, ultimately with this whole eating better meat and feeling better about it thing, it's like you want to be closer to the actual animal. And since probably none of us are breaking down whole cows and pigs in our houses, you know, buying a whole chicken is one, a really good way to kind of feel connected to that, the whole animal and that process. It's also a lot better for chicken farmers because they don't have to worry about them getting broken down and parted out and whatever. You know, you got to remember if you're buying a 12 pack of chicken thighs that came off of six chickens or probably 12 chickens.
Yeah.
So, you know, getting the whole bird is actually, it not only does it make you feel kind of better and more connected to that whole process, but there's also just so much possibility. You know, you roast a chicken one day and then you, whatever you have left over, you take the meat off and then you can make a stock with the carcass. And then the next day you have chicken soup or chicken salad. You know, there's so much more to the chicken than just meat.
Yeah, so you can really sort of extend that also. Okay, so you do the roast, you don't finish it, but the next day, like, oh, I've got the makings for some yummy, you know, whatever, however you want to flavor your chicken salad for your desk lunch the next day. Yeah. With the carcass, like, do you Are you making stock from just one carcass? Are you the type, Alton Brown, who was on our podcast a while ago back, he said he has like just a big bag of frozen carcasses in his freezer and waits till he has enough to make a big stock pot? Like, what's your...
That
what's
really
your...
makes Alton Brown sound like a serial killer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's a little crazy, in a good way. You know, what do you do it as you go? Do you save them? How do you do
it? I mean, to me, I like to think of myself as somebody who would save a lot of carcasses in my freezer, but realistically, it's like I roast a chicken and then... That with that carcass, I make whatever stock I can. Yeah. So that's probably not going to be like your richest, your like ramen, like chicken ramen quality stock, but it's still going to have flavor and, you know, a little bit of that delicious chicken fat. And, you know, in that case, I might add more onions or a little bit of kombu
carrots
or something
or
to kind of.
Something to
veg to bulk it up.
And then what do you, I'm always wondering, like, a lot of times my problem with chicken stock is I'll make the chicken stock. I'm like, oh, I got a quart of chicken stock. And I put it in my freezer and I put the little date on with my Sharpie. And then 4 months later, I'm like, I forgot all about that chicken stock, and it's still in my freezer. And I'm like, is it too old? Is it too frozen now?
No.
Like, what do you use your chicken stock for?
I mean, sometimes if I come home and I don't know what I want to make for dinner, I'll just I open my freezer first.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I've got a quart of chicken stock. Put it on the stove. Get it heated up.
You got some various carcasses in there.
Yeah, all the carcasses. No, but it's like, you know, chicken stock. I mean, you think about thawing things that are in your freezer, but stock is the thing that you just put frozen into a pan and it thaws itself. You know,
well, that's true.
Heat.
Yeah.
And then you're ready to make a quick noodle soup or to, you know, just cook some, you know, start a little bit of a stew or something.
Well, I like what
like
you
that.
Said before about when you're making the larb, like say you're browning that meat and then having a ladle or two of chicken stock to throw in there and sizzle away and sort of moisten it up. Sometimes with making a pasta sauce that comes in handy,
totally.
I think. I like that sort of. And also, I remember when I made fried rice with Danny Bowen from Mission Chinese a year or two ago for an editor's letter. After Danny sort of crisps up the rice and he's got some egg and all that sort of stuff in there, he'll take a ladle of chicken stock and throw it in there to sort of loosen up the rice. But then all that rice absorbs that sort of richness and that umami-ness from the chicken stock.
Yeah, I feel like stock never goes to waste in my fridge, especially, you know, like last night, actually, I thawed a quart of some garlicky chicken stock and I just sauteed some frozen peas with a lot of ginger, a lot of garlic, added that stock and then just ladle that over fried bread and like the peas and the brothy mixture, and you know, that was dinner, and that was along with some leftover ribs from the test kitchen.
All right, yeah, bind bone in cuts, which sort of segues nicely from whole chickens. What are we talking here?
So, I mean, here we're talking about, you know, your short ribs, you're talking about your bone in pork chops, you're talking about, you know,
oxtails.
Yep.
Because I've made that mistake before. I think I made the mistake. I bought short ribs to braise, and I bought boneless ones. And I'm like, well, why did I buy – shouldn't I have just got with the bones for making the stock and the broth and all? Isn't bones better?
I mean, look, the reality of the situation is you're paying for the bones whether you're getting them or not. Mm-hmm. So if you look at two of the same cut, you're looking at boneless and bone-in short ribs. The boneless are going to be more expensive because they weighed them before they took the bones out. So you may as well take the bones home.
Those bastards.
I know. You know, hey, they're trying to make a living. But, you know, those bones, when you're braising your short ribs, like you're talking about, those are going to lend that cooking liquid, all of that kind of gelatinous, lip-sticking quality, which contributes to the satiety that you experience. When you're, you know, it's like when you've got a braise like that, you want to put it over a grain or a noodle or something like that.
Polenta,
and that's gonna
perhaps.
Polenta. And that's going to mean that it's not just every bite of meat that you get that's meaty, it's every bite that you're getting is going to benefit from that kind of meatiness.
Yeah, if you ever make oxtail, there's probably more tail than there is meat on oxtail. But one thing that's great about it, it does lend that syrupy stickiness, like richness to the sauce as you cook them down. And that just, yeah, like I said, whether you're eating with rice or some sort of grain or noodles, that goes so far.
Right.
Again, you don't need as much meat because the sauce that the bones and the meat impart and the flavor that imparts into the sauce is so rich and sort of potent that it sort of can extend to whatever else is on the plate.
Totally. And depending on how you're cooking, so, you know, also, if you're getting a bone-in pork chop, it's like you're a boneless pork chop. Like, what? You don't want to gnaw on the bone? You don't want all those crispy bits? Like, bones are good. We like bones.
Oh, yeah. Bones are pro. I told you that's my pro move when I'm grilling. It's not grilling season, but I buy the bone-in ribeye.
Uh-huh.
And then before I grill the ribeye, I cut the bone out, season the ribeye steak, grill each separately. So the bone gets grilled separately, so it gets super crispy and crunchy and seasoned on all sides, as opposed to grilling it whole and then cutting off the bone. Then the inside of the bone is basically raw meat that's unflavored and unseasoned.
Have you ever thought, I mean, you know, butcher shops sell a lot of boneless ribeyes. Have you ever thought about going to Florence Meat Market and asking them for ribeye bones? Just with that little bit of meat left on them so that you can grill those?
Actually, I forgot. When I got married, or after I got married, because Simone and I eloped, that's a whole other story. I think that's for the Brides podcast. I don't know what time Brides records here at Condé Nast. But we ended up having a party several months later at Del Posto, where Simone was doing the flowers at the time. And Mark Ladner, the chef, we did prime rib, which generally I'm not a huge fan of, but he cooked it so perfectly. It was awesome. He cooked the prime rib, and as it was resting at a perfect medium rare, he cut all the bones off and then put them through a bandsaw so they were sort of cut into sort of like inch and a half size nuggets, seasoned them aggressively, and deep fried them. So all the meat and everything in them, they were like these. So in the middle of the table was a bowl of prime rib bone nuggets.
So they're like steak wings.
They were so good. I was just like,
that sounds really
good. It was so genius. And I was like, oh my God. Could not stop eating those. So God bless you, Mark Ladner.
Hey.
All right. We got a couple more advisories here. So this is one where I feel like I'm on board with, I get it, and yet I never do it. And you're talking about cured meat is a cure-all. Cooking with cured meat changes everything for us, even a tiny amount of spicy, ruddy chorizo or smoky andouille, which makes the quote-unquote meat as seasoning thing that chefs talk about feel a lot more doable. So I guess that's my question. Like, so I say I do have some cured meat, or what am I doing? I don't quite get how do I, because typically if I have like a good salami, I'm just, as I'm cooking dinner, I'm sort of slicing that off and eating that as I'm making pasta. I never sort of combine the two.
Well, I mean, I think if you think about some of these cured meats, and right, we're talking about like chorizo, andouille, salami, you know, any of those things, prosciutto, whatever.
Pancetta. Prosciutto is pretty expensive to use as a frying pan meat.
But, you know, even bacon, you know, falls into this category. If that is a part of your seasoning base, you know, with your onions, garlic, whatever, if you think about it kind of as like a really powerful, meaty, aromatic, I feel like that's the way that I kind of start. So it's like if you're want to turn kind of a pot of beans that kind of feels like, all right, it's
bland.
Beans. Yeah.
A little basic.
A little basic.
As the kids would say.
Capital B.
Well, I think most of it, if you ever had split pea soup with a little bit of pork in there, all of a sudden it takes on a different dimension.
Exactly. And that's lending a lot of things. That's lending some salt and seasoning, but it's also adding some fat. So you're getting kind of that richness that you associate with eating meat without, you know, when you may be adding 4 ounces or less to something that's going to feed 4 people, you know, that's an ounce per person.
Yeah. And this one, we have a recipe for chorizo, tomato, and chickpeas. So it's like a chickpea stew that is suffused, I guess, with andouille sausage.
Right.
Bits.
Totally. And also, you know, it's like a lot of these sausages are fermented too in their sort, you know, they're dried. And so it's concentrated flavor, but you also get kind of that complexity, that umami that you might not get from the fresh version of that meat.
And frankly, saltiness. It's like flavored salt as opposed to just like Morton salt, which are dumb. Because I've tried to make like bean soups and stuff, and when I make them without any sort of meaty products, I feel like I'm just adding more and more salt because I'm like, this doesn't taste like anything.
Yeah, I mean, the reality of the situation is that beans need a lot of salt, and most people don't put enough in, and that's why they're sad when they cook beans.
It is, because I'm like trying to be healthy-ish. I'm like, I'm just going to make a nice white bean soup, and then I'm like adding more and more salt because I'm like, this kind of sucks.
Yeah, I mean, if it doesn't taste good enough that you want to actually eat it, then what's the point?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, last point. Pork chops are the new ribeyes. In terms of the whole new meat sort of thing, like grass-fed meat is definitely a huge thing these days, and it should be. It's more environmentally beneficial. It's better for us as carnivores or omnivores. I do feel, though, that grass-fed beef is different tasting than a lot of us grew up with. It is now becoming more marbled and more suffused with fat in a way that's sort of pleasing to what that sort of those steakhouse cuts we're used to. But it's still it's sort of a different breed. However, on the pork side of things, the kind of the grocery store pork we grew up with was pretty bland. It was the other white meat, not very flavorful, not very juicy. These days, though, with all the sort of heritage breed pork out there that you can get at some of these specialty butchers or farmers markets, It is rich and jackets of clean white fat, and it is juicy, and it is the most indulgent, enjoyable thing I eat on a regular basis or semi-regular basis. I'll go buy a beautiful, big, thick pork chop, cook it just under medium, medium rare medium. I'm like, oh my God, it's like, it's so good. And I love a ribeye, but I don't know, a really good pork chop these days is right up there.
Well, and I think that's the thing. You know, it's like also, I mean, this is also in the story, but as far as what kinds of meat you wanted, what animals you want to be eating, you know, it's like we should probably be eating less cow. The cows just, they take a lot longer to grow and to develop and to develop the fat that you want. And just they're a lot more resource intensive versus pigs, which grow really fast, have, you know, huge litters of baby pigs, you know, on the regular, and they eat basically compost, you know, they like eat, they're total omnivores. And so that is just a, it's a from an ecological standpoint, eating pork is better than eating beef. Now that you can't eat beef, it's just maybe that ribeye is more of a special occasion. Like, hey, I just, I don't know what, I don't know what people celebrate.
I just got off work.
Yeah, I just got off work. Right, exactly. So save that. But then in the meantime, a pork chop, you know, the thing that's great about a pork chop too is you were talking about how that beautiful band of fat on like a heritage breed pork chop, it's, you know, a little bit goes a long way. So if you have a big double bone pork chop and you cut, you know, grill it and you cut it off the bone and you cut it into slices and present it at the table.
I will say this, Simone and I, a lot of times, I won't even do the double bone. Sometimes a nice single bone will do. And because
for two.
And but as we talked about before, when you have meat, like in the ground beef with the lamb larb, when there's a lot of intense seasonings, that flavor goes farther. And with a pork chop, that fat goes farther. And it's very sating. And two people, if you have a rich, juicy, fatty, crispy pork chop with a nice sort of, what's our salad we have here that you come
to? It's a really good salad. This is Claire Saffitz. Made a beautiful apple and celery root salad. And it's got cheese and it's got nuts and it's got frisée and also like leaf lettuce. And it's really satisfying. Yeah. It's not like, you know, gone are the days where you're going to sit down to a steak dinner and have like a big chop in front of you and like a kind of perfunctory little cold salad with ranch on the side and whatever. It's like you want the salad to be as much a part of the meal as that chop, and you're gonna have like a couple of slices of that pork chop, and then, you know, also fill up on salad, and you're not gonna feel like you're wanting.
Yeah, you know, eat your meat, eat less of it, but eat better of it. Can I say that?
Yeah, you can say that. Yeah, you can say that. That works.
I just did.
You just did.
All right, thanks, dude.
Thanks, Adam.
This podcast has been brought to you by Carrie Polis, Emma Wertzman, and Lily Sherman, with editing by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.